My name is Jeff Harbach. I'm the CEO of Coffin Fellows and the host of the Coffin Fellows podcast. This season, our podcast is produced in partnership with Mighty Capital and features different Coffin Fellows as co-hosts. In this podcast, we dive deep into the personal narratives of some of the most successful names in the venture capital industry. But we're not here just to explore their highlight reels, however impressive they are. From failures and formative learning experiences to inflection points and aha moments, we discuss the real, authentic journeys that each individual goes through to become the best version of themselves in order to best serve the entrepreneurs they invest in. Covering various themes in venture capital investing, we speak with the world's top leaders in capital formation, all from a place of authenticity and vulnerability. Together, we'll unravel what truly makes a great venture capital investor. Now let's meet today's host and their guest.
Hi, my name is Maddie Callender, VP at Boost VC, the 500K accelerator for sci-fi tech. And I'm thrilled to host this series, Women Leading Deep Tech Investments, featuring the stories, motivations, and industry insights of venture capitalists who are taking big risks on the next generation of deep tech founders. Now, let me introduce my guest today.
I want to give a warm welcome to Mariana Sanko, co-founder and partner at Future Ventures. Thank you so much for joining me today. I am so excited to have you here. Let's get this started. I will hand it off to you to let you introduce yourself.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. Such a delight to be speaking with you, Maddie. Hi, all. My name's Mariana Sanko. I am a co-founder and partner at Future Ventures. We're an early stage Bay Area-based venture capital fund, and we're focused on frontier technology investments.
Would you mind sharing a little bit more about your background and what led you to Future Ventures?
Yeah, absolutely. I never expected to be a venture capitalist. I had no idea that creatures called venture capitalists existed until, honestly, my mid-20s, which maybe speaks more to my lack of informed perspective. I'm a recovering engineer, and I had intended to spend my life as a research scientist and ideally an academic. That's what I was taught to kind of streamline towards. And so my academic background is a mix of material science, biomedical engineering, and robotics. I had the pleasure of working on all sorts of interesting projects, everything from lunar rovers to long-range low frequency communication to all sorts of interesting robots. And I think that really bred in me a desire to learn not just about the future of technology, but the interesting intersection between kind of fields of technology that are advancing in parallel and where suddenly overlap at the edges becomes viable and interesting. And those boundary layers are really where I get to play today.
What got you into the investing side of it, and why are you still in the investing side? What makes you excited about the investing portion of it?
It's a longer story, but the short version is I effectively left graduate school because I decided that spending 8 years on a narrow focused PhD just didn't speak to my generalist core bones. And I ended up at a tiny little startup, and we mostly raised government kind of non-dilutive funding. And I learned some of the very, very difficult pain points associated with tacking on these SBIR grants on top of NSF grants and having kind of competing modalities. And that's when I kind of first heard of venture capital and saw some peers working for companies where they just had much more streamlined forms of capital that allowed them to stay more focused. I ended up working for a larger organization and was honestly just infuriated by the fact that I was running a number of research experiments within Cabot Corporation, which was it's a large material science company based on the East Coast. And every so often they would basically kill all of our projects because some random strategist would show up and tell board members and executives in the company how to optimize shareholder value and just had no concept of, you know, how that would just basically degrade institutional knowledge and how shifting our experimental plans ad hoc really kind of destabilized us in our terms of our capacity to build novel products. Now, the company's gone on to do and continues to do lots of interesting things, but I was just shocked, you know, how am I working inside a company that's not being driven by the scientists and the engineers, but by kind of these questions of how to optimize shareholder value. I couldn't justify paying for business school. And so I found myself into a consulting role, mostly from the perspective of I really wanted someone to pay me to take business education. And that's exactly what I did. And so I was fortunate enough to join an organization called Lux Research, where we advise Fortune 500 companies on kind of the latest trends in innovation and in startups and in technology factors. And this is really what drove me into venture capital, was realizing that those same large clients who were our customers were doing some interesting things, but were generally getting lapped by startups. And it made no sense to me until I figured out that there was these creatures called venture capitalists who were giving those startups interesting sums of money, and they were actually able to innovate on a time frame that these large corporations, you know, they were busy scratching their ears, and by the time they opened their eyes, they figured out that, like, oh, drones are now a thing, and that's actually a huge consumer product. And you know, there were plenty of companies who could have done something about that, but you know, DJI kind of took the world by storm out of a drone. And I remember just seeing that trend was going to repeat itself about 1,000 times over, and that I really don't like being on the side of the table that's kind of waiting and watching. And that's really what motivated me. And so I found myself into corporate venture capital as kind of a stepping stone into more financially driven venture capital.
That's a great story. Let's dig into Future Ventures thesis. You know, what are you looking for? What are you investing in? And how would you define deep tech or frontier tech?
Oh, I mean, these definitions are challenging. So I'll start with the definition piece, because I think the definitions are challenging and it's a constantly moving target, right? One would argue that's similar to like the singularity. It's maybe not a single point in our future state where you know, technology advances, but so much as a perspective question, right? So something that 30 years ago was considered frontier or deep technology, by the very nature of time passing, is no longer that today. So I would define frontier technology as what is just over the horizon of capability to produce in mass today from a technological standpoint, but that scientifically, and at least from, you know, thermodynamic and first principle of physics, actually closes. So there's a difference between pure research science and frontier technology. And it's a subtle difference, and we can have lots of etymological arguments on the finer points here. But my perspective is that frontier technology is that space just beyond basic research science, where we're trying to describe the fundamentals of how our universe works, and a bit before you actually are at a known, well-understood, easily scalable, and mass-producible form of technology. I think that this is a moving target across essentially every field. And so what we have as an investment thesis is to chase that moving target, to look across the diaspora of these frontier technologies, whether they be in semiconductor processing, in advanced algorithmic techniques, in machine learning and AI, in how we could look at genetic data and metagenomic data and, you know, create larger simulation structures and off of that build better therapeutics for our world. So to me, it's our investment thesis, as Steve and I prescribe it, is we look for novel technology, things unlike anything we've seen before, that hopefully make the world a better place, and that most importantly, don't prey on human frailty. Because while I'm a techno-optimist and I think that technology can solve an enormous amount of problems in the world and generally do good, I also think it's very important to consider all of the second order effects and, you know, the risky subjugations of just blindly believing that technology can do no harm.
I love the techno-optimist perspective. That's great. Tying that into that, what do you think are some of the most important challenges we're facing today? And how does deep tech play a role in solving those challenges?
Oh, I mean, where do you start, right? Socioeconomic disparity, food scarcity and food access, clean water access. One of the principles that I tend to look at the world at is don't try to solve for the altruistic case. Try to solve for the economic case, in the sense that if your solution is economically viable and better for the world, then it's not that people will choose it because it's the kinder option. They'll choose it because it's the economically rational option. And I think that there's a real kindness in this, and considering that a lot of the more painful points of our existence are people making decisions that are at the cost of others. And I think it's easy to point at any one group and say, well, you know, they don't care about the environment, or some other group is doing some terrible business practice at the cost of another group. And my perspective is a compassionate view here is they're making the best economic rational argument that they can perceive and justify. And so what I believe in technology is our capacity to change the economics, right? To change the economics such that, well, what if there was a cleaner and cheaper way to generate energy, right? What if we could actually make green hydrogen, right? And then that hydrogen fuel source was actually a more efficient fuel source than burning dead dinosaur bones. And what if, you know, actually it made sense to electrify everything, not because it was a nice thing to do, but because it just actually made sense. Mm-hmm. And so this is kind of how we look at the world, is we look for these inherent inefficiencies that are solved with really, really crude technologies. And we say, well, how can more sophisticated and elegant technology bring about a greater sense of abundance in this market, such that people are more inclined to make the choice that will be net better for everyone?
And what are you looking at right now, or what's getting you really excited in the space at the moment?
It's been a wild ride. You know, we as investors, because we have this thesis, Steve and I, that we invest across novel areas against things unlike anything we've ever seen. We often have no idea what we'll be investing in, right? It's not that it's a random walk through idea space so much as we're always kind of growing and looking. And so recently, we've done a pretty deep dive into regenerative agriculture, into basically agricultural practices that are less net extractive on our lands and actually regenerative. And so I've been, along with Steve, looking at every aspect of this from, you know, how can agriculture do a better job in reducing carbon emissions by root, you know, whether it's actually genetically modifying the plants and the rootstocks, looking at, we invested in a company called BeeFlow, which is focused on bee immunology and basically bee immune system health, which net affects better outcomes for crops and higher yields, which means fewer inputs. So, right. So if you can have healthier bees and more crops as a result of that, you actually need to use less energy and resource. We're also spending a fair bit of time looking at advances in understanding harvest of crops computationally and understanding where there are efficiencies to be gained. We've always been huge supporters of this kind of alternative protein space. We're investors in Upside Foods, formerly known as Memphis Meats, and that's a company that's focused on creating cell cultured animal proteins. So you get to eat the cow without having to have a cow grow and suffer on behalf of that. And so I think that lately, just in the last couple of months, we found in ourselves a real kind of flourishing of technologies and opportunities within inside this agriculture space that we're really excited about. I think we're also seeing a fair amount of opportunities in the construction space and broader kind of construction and logistics, which are, you know, just huge, painful markets in terms of, you know, net GDP, but net efficiency. I can't even say net efficiency gains. It's really net efficiency losses. We're talking about global industries that have become less efficient rather than more with time.
As you're evaluating these teams and founders, you know, what are you looking for in a founder or a founding team?
Yeah, it's worth saying that we're really, while we sound tech obsessed, and we are because we're engineers and nerds, and that, you know, that's kind of our lifeblood and the reason we do this job. We're actually, companies are nothing without people, and startups are nothing without the founders. You can have the best technology in the world, but without the right founding spirit that subsequently builds the culture in the company, there is no company. And so we don't invest in the science just for the sake of the science. We actually really just fundamentally invest in the people. And what that means is we ask a couple of questions, which is a founding team or individual founder uniquely positioned to be answering this question space? Because you know, there are a lot of people who can point out the interesting and relevant problems, but we really look for the founders who have some unique angle, whether it's through education, personal life experience, some other axis on which they are uniquely motivated, right? I love almost this idea of the reluctant founder, in the sense of the person who's like, you know, there's a lot of things I could be doing with my life, and I'd rather be doing maybe a bunch of them, because starting a startup is quite difficult, but oh, this thing just has to exist in the world, and I keep trying to get it out there, and no one else is going to do it, so fine, right? That attitude of the mission-driven intensity of a person who just says, okay, this technology just needs to come to light, and no one else is going to do it, and we're capable and uniquely qualified to do so. That is the most motivating thing. The second axis that we always look for, and this is a little bit of one of my kind of favorite metrics to look at, is that initial founder or founding team capable of hiring, right? Are they capable of selling their mission such that people are leaving jobs with good salaries where they arguably have a lot more stability and security to join this crazy rocket ship? And to any founder who comes to me and says, well, I can't hire this team until, you know, we get fundraising, the answer is no, you just can't hire that team. If you are sufficiently motivated, working on a cool enough problem, and have the right mission alignment, people will be willing to join your little rowboat.
I love that. That's really fun. Thank you for sharing. Next question is around the funding the deep tech funding puzzle. With research institutions, with government grants, with industry, how should investors be thinking about the deep tech funding puzzle?
Yeah. And, you know, I'll say that I don't know that we have the perfect answer to this. And one of the things that we'll always say is, you know, if you're an entrepreneur who is endeavoring to start a deep tech company that requires hundreds of millions of dollars of capital before you prove anything, it's probably not the best thing to start and try to raise venture dollars for, right? There are many forms of grant and non-dilutive capital and government support that would allow the maturity of the technology to progress to a point where you can at least build something meaningful and sizable and of a proof point to a market. Because we've generally stayed away from companies that require billions of dollars before you get customer buy-in. Now, someone could state, well, but you guys are investors in SpaceX, so isn't that hypocritical? It's not, actually, right? So SpaceX actually had contractual customer agreements with NASA very early on that helped offset the development costs. So it's not that you can't go do these insane, large, really high vision thinking deep tech development programs. It's that you better have a customer who really wants to spend money on it. And not doing so, I think, is a recipe for disaster. And I honestly look at a number of the companies in the markets these days and go, oh man, they're on track to spend $1 billion before they build anything or certify anything. And that just seems like a really risky proposition.
Yeah. So still looking to de-risk this customer side as much as possible.
And I think you can do that early. You know, the reality is that the customers exist. There's a huge, there's a lot of capital flowing through markets right now. So it's, you know, I think that for the right problem statement, there are lots of interesting customers, including in the automotive space, including in the aerospace space, including in the agriculture space, who are willing to engage in fiscal contractual agreements early, not just letters of intent of, if you ever build this thing, I might maybe pay you, but it's up to me and I can cancel at any point. That doesn't mean much. But contractual obligations with customers, maybe not for the full, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars that they'll eventually be paying you, but, you know, such that the customers are actually on the hook and they're engaged in the process. I think that's also really valuable because it means that a company is naturally iterating with its customer set.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And one more question on sort of thinking about a fund thesis or your fund strategy. What expectations do you set for your LPs when you think about investing in frontier technologies?
We're so fortunate. We have an amazing LP base. We call our LPs real people who care about the future rather than somewhat faceless institutions. And within that, we've actually gotten our LPs to we told this story and our LPs were the ones who in turn said, yes, that seems like the right approach for us. Now, that perspective is that we believe this takes a while. And so our funds, of which we've raised two $200 million funds, are each 15-year funds. And really what that means is that in years, you know, 4, 5, and 6, when many funds on a shorter time frame are considering, how do I extract my capital? We're thinking, how do we pour more fuel on this fire? Because we understand that the outsized opportunity in the successful companies actually happens in those later years. What that also gives the nice perspective that we're a little bit more patient with entrepreneurs, that we understand truly to the best that we can the timelines of innovation that they're trying to operate on. And in turn, our LPs are really patient and supportive capital. So they're actively trying to help these companies, particularly in those later years.
Thank you for digging into that. I appreciate those insights. I want to transition over into the diversity and deep tech side of things. You have been in this ecosystem for a while now. How have you seen the ecosystem change in the last few years? And what would you like to see in the next 5 years?
I would say it's getting better, but not fast enough. And that onus is on all of us to address. And here's what I mean by that is, you know, when I got started in venture capital, I was fortunate that there were a few other venture capitalist investors. And I was fortunate that there were amazing women like Lori Yoler, who has a deep technical background and wasn't afraid of diving into these deeply technical companies. So I had kind of mentors to aspire to. And I think that it's been great to see more women as investors taking on roles as managing directors and as partners and you know, that the associate and principal levels being more stacked with more female investors is good. And I used to think that it didn't matter that much, but now increasingly I realize that it's a thing that can make female entrepreneurs feel more comfortable and feel more heard. I've also now been, I'll tell you the difference between being on a board that everyone looks the same and you're the one odd person out feels really different than being on a board that has diversity across the axes of gender, race, age. And it's a lot more delightful. It's delightful to be on the latter kind of board and less fun to be on the former. So I think things are getting better. I think it's actually more important to have representation than I realized previously. And so I'm actively making efforts of understanding how I can be more of a champion for young women coming into venture capital. What I would really love to see, what irks me a little bit, is this penchant that I see that, you know, female investors are good at femtech. And sure, that's great. I mean, it's better than saying that only male investors are good at femtech. But, you know, there's like this implied period at the end of that statement, rather than they're good at femtech and everything else. And so I would really love to see female investors focusing across all sectors. And there's plenty who are and who are doing an absolutely spectacular job. And I won't name all of them, but there are so many women in this field that I admire. But I would just really love to see, particularly in the frontier technologies, to get away from this just honestly little niche of sector of technologies, which are important and great, but are by no means the whole world. And because you're doing femtech doesn't mean you shouldn't be doing everything else.
Yes.
And so it irks me to see people effectively pigeonholing others into these buckets of female investors are good at investing in X. No, female investors are good at investing.
Yes.
That's it.
100%.
And the data will bear out in years, you know, as we see more diversity in the field. What I'm excited about is that I am seeing more female investors. I am desperately trying to figure out how to see more female entrepreneurs. And I see the same femtech challenge there, which is brilliant female entrepreneurs know that there are certain things that they can go and pitch and get funded almost without question. And that's often in these femtech spaces. I would love to see more female entrepreneurs pitching everyone in climate and in, you know, nuclear fusion and in whatever the hell they feel like working on.
Yes.
I'm excited to see them and meet them and support them.
Yes. Yeah, that leads to my next question. Do you have any ideas of how we can get more female and underrepresented founders into the deep tech space and into the deep tech fields and starting companies?
I was just on a panel with a group from the National Academy of the Sciences, literally asking this question. And, you know, it's really tough because, for one, I think we have a challenge, which is if you look at the access of the average age of successful entrepreneur is actually closer to in their 40s than in their 20s. And the rad women who are amazing engineering and science leaders who are in their 40s are just, you know, exceptionally well paid and supported at these giant tech companies that are fighting tooth and nail over their skills. And so it's hard to extract them. But, you know, that's a good problem to have. I think that we just need to show, maybe through education, through universities, I think we need to celebrate the stories of successful female entrepreneurs and do so in a way that doesn't gloss over the difficulties and that doesn't, you know, create some biased view of they were really tough and they were willing to, you know, suffer at all odds. Like, all of those things are true, but just to celebrate the stories the same way that we celebrate, you know, the Steve Jobses of the world.
Yes.
And I think that that's on us, that's on the media, that's on us from a historical perspective to look at amazing women from the past and actually know their names, right? Like, I wish that people knew the name of Hedy Lamarr just as well as they know the name of Nikola Tesla. And I think it starts with education, but it honestly starts with every time you meet a young woman and she suggests that, hey, you know, I maybe want to do this, to support her. And honestly, you do that with any young person and to say,
yes,
yeah, that's going to be tough. And here are the reasons that might fail. And here are some resources, right? And I think we need to look at entrepreneurship not as the correct answer for everyone. I think that this is also important, is
yes,
we live in a culture of, you know, the cult of the individual, and the entrepreneur often takes the peak of that stack. And I think the reality is it's not the right role for everyone. It's not the right role for me. That's why I'm an investor. I still celebrate entrepreneurs, but when I meet an entrepreneur who I think will be fantastic, I do everything to elevate them. And when I meet one who I think, man, I just don't think you're going to be super happy in this role, and here are the challenges that I perceive, you know, to be honest about those as well.
Yeah, I agree. I think the role model piece, creating more historical and current role models to inspire the next generation, is a really important piece. And I agree, the entrepreneurship culture is a little bit cult-like at the moment, and making sure that people understand that it's not for everyone and that there are so many incredible opportunities out there, both across the entrepreneurship ecosystem, but in so many other business ecosystems that need very specific and talented people and their skills. You know, jumping from there into what do you think makes a great deep tech venture capitalist or investor? What are the qualities that you see that would define a great VC?
I think a perennially curious mind, and specifically in the frontier technology spaces, you really have to be willing to give up your bias, to hold it, right? To walk into a conversation and say, okay, you know, I just walked out of a meeting with an entrepreneur just before this who's trying to share with me a perspective that a vision-based approach to mobile robotics, so a visual solution to the simultaneous localization and mapping problem, is the correct approach. And that not because it's cheaper, but because it's a technologically superior approach. For me, this from, you know, 15 years of education is heresy, because I grew up in an environment where the vision sensors were terrible and sensor fusion was the only approach. And so all of my academic bias and personal experience and years of looking at investments suggest that no, like a sensor fusion with a 3D point cloud based on a LiDAR system is the correct way to solve this problem. But I have to pause and set that bias aside and say, okay, but what if he's right, right? What if there's a way to do a vision-based system in real time at, you know, at some appropriate frame rate with this kind of fidelity? And it's, you know, this sounds like a simple example, but it's an example of the statement of you have to walk into every meeting and hold your opinions and know what the challenges are, have been in the past, and also have the flexibility and the curiosity to say, yeah, but what if the technology moved, right? What if it like completely moved past me while I wasn't looking? And the next time I blinked and opened my eyes, we were in a very different world. And so you have to always be willing in the frontier technology spaces to suddenly be willing to invest in something that you've actively passed on every single time for the last whatever 5 years.
That's great. So tying right into that curiosity, how do you personally stay curious? What sort of books or podcasts or blogs do you read? And then, of course, I will ask for a sci-fi recommendation as well.
I'm an obsessive reader across all things. You know, I spend a lot of time reading poetry. I spend a lot of time reading surrealist fiction. On the more work side of things, I try to keep an open mind and bounce around between books and publications. So I think that there's always so many fascinating kind of frontier technology, you know, pop sci books that are coming out. Most of them feel a little light on depth of content. And as a venture capitalist, you quickly find that you're more informed than the average public. And so some of those books fall flat. But I try to read those books to educate myself on sectors where I'm less informed. I recently read the story of Jennifer Doudna's Nobel Prize winning work on CRISPR called Codebreaker, which I do recommend as an excellent read on the topic. I spent a lot of time reading Quanta magazine and understanding kind of, you know, from a cosmological standpoint. I really appreciate Sean Carroll's podcast, Mindscape. And there's another podcast that's British, which is quite hilarious. I think it's called Infinite Monkey Cage with Brian Cox and Robert Innes, which is half comedy show, half science. And honestly, I listen to a lot of Planet Money just to remind myself of macro scale economics, because we often look at things on a micro level. And so for me, it's a reading is a running target. And the best I can do is just try to keep my eyes and ears open and constantly be in response to what are my peers reading and what are they recommending. I mean, there was a book called by Judea Pearl, I think it was called like The Art of Why or something like that. Don't hold me to the title, but I recall the author's name. It reframed for me the concept of bias in decision-making in a way that I, you know, was not expecting to have reframed in my life. And I think that that kind of reading and to recognize that that's available to us is just such a delight.
Yeah. Well, I want to check out some of those podcasts and blogs or book recommendations. So this is the final question for today. Thank you so much again for being here. You know, what fuels you? I mean, you have so many interests and so many curiosities. You are doing so many different things. What fuels you to keep learning and growing and doing all this great work?
I mean, why else are we here? I suppose that's my personal philosophy. I'm not a morning person, but by the time I've actually woken up in the morning, I find that something is always grabbing my attention. And whether that sense of, I think it's why I became a scientist and an engineer originally, that sense of trying to understand the universe. And, you know, it's such a complex system. It has such crazy emergent behaviors. Life is such a chaotic experience. And to be able to pause and just look at a tree blossoming and understand something about what that blossom means and how when that one gets pollinated before its others, it will start growing fruit. And that, you know, the amount of fruit you allow a tree to grow affects how many resources it has and how sweet the fruit is. I mean, I think it was Feynman who wrote about this, that there's such a beauty in understanding the world. And that's really what drives me, not from an ego perspective, but just because I don't know. There's so many things to learn, and they often stack on one another. You know, you learn something in a sector, and then it suddenly allows you to be more inspired in understanding of something else. And maybe I'm just a person who's afraid of being left in the dark, but I really appreciate being able to understand what's going on around me.
Oh, I love that. I really appreciate the beauty and understanding the world component as a fueling motivation for all that you do and all that you invest in. So thank you for being here today. This was so fun. I learned a lot, and I can't wait for our future conversations and hopefully co-investments down the road. So this was great. Thanks, Mariana.
Oh, such a delight. Thank you so much. This was super fun.
That's a wrap. Tune in next week for another candid conversation on what makes a great VC investor with your host, the Kaufman Fellows.